everyone should have access to opportunities for growth and education, and certainly in the arts. Everyone should have access to the arts, because the arts are for everyone, and everyone is creative.
And if you have an arts practice, I think for so many of us as writers, so much of writing is about asking those questions and coming to the page just utterly confused and utterly lost and utterly like, what's going on? What is happening? And that's exactly where you should be, and write about it and use your arts practice to write into that.
Welcome to the third installment of the Chapters podcast series. I'm your host, John Barrett Ingalls, along with Jonelle Strickland. In our chapter series, we focus on stories surrounding the exclusion, forced removal, and internment of Japanese Americans. But with all that is happening in our country right now, in this historic moment ripe with the potential for change and growth, we are expanding our scope and amplifying the voices of organizations and artists who are trying to make a difference, who are standing at the convergence of art, education, and social justice. With this series, we honor those who have struggled and suffered in the past and question, how are we still here? How have we not come any further than this? In this episode, we connect with Lilia Chavez of the Fresno Arts Council and Bryn Saito, the co-creator of the Yonsei Memory Project. Lilia Chavez is the executive director of the Fresno Arts Council, and in February of 2020, Lilia was appointed by Governor Newsom to the California Arts Council. Here's Lilia talking to me about the importance of equity in arts and in arts education.
The arts have seen a wane in support because of a lack of arts education in our schools. Without a strong arts education in our schools program, we do a couple of things. One, we don't create future patrons of the arts. So we have literally maybe three generations of people that have gone through school without strong arts education programs. And because of that, they don't necessarily understand the value of art or even appreciate it in many instances. So that's a bit of a concern. The other thing is, when we consider equity in the arts, if we're not validating art in our schools, we're not teaching it, we're not identifying it as important, then young people who maybe have art experiences at home because it's part of their culture, it's not validated in the school, and so therefore it becomes less valuable. It seems like, well, that's not really art, that's just what we do. And right. I've heard people say that. It's that, you know, they may, whether it's Dante with African drumming, or it's someone who does beautiful stitchery, embroidery, because that's what they learned at home. It's not valued because, well, you know, we don't do that at school. I'm not going to make money doing this. And so again, the arts, if they're not validated within our school system, they become less important. And people who do it choose not to continue to practice because, again, no one has validated it. So
these that you're talking about, like art that is rooted in culture and history, like you were talking about the African drumming or the Yonsei Memory Project, like these, or your own work with folklorico dance, like talk a little bit about how important it is to get this work out, this historical cultural work out, and to honor it and to let it flourish, especially in this time that we're in, where things are splintering apart.
I think that when we think about our population as a whole, and we look at the diversity of our population, and we know that many people have art forms that they practice in their homes. The point of validity is so critical to anyone continuing their work. If no one acknowledges that that work has value. In our society here in the United States, we then minimize it and decide, as we assimilate, decide to no longer engage in it and practice it. But yet, these art forms are so important to our overall well-being. They're a part of who we are. People who engage in textile arts, like weaving and stitching, any of those things, it's therapeutic. It allows for a point of mindfulness, an opportunity for us to be whole with ourselves and engage in a creative process that helps us grow as individuals and makes us healthy. And when we don't do those things, then we lose a very important part of who we are. And we struggle as individuals to find our place. And so when we also don't value or acknowledge these cultural art forms, we then minimize the importance of the populations that do practice them. We don't elevate them to the same level as perhaps a symphony or a ballet or an opera. All of those art forms are beautiful art forms and certainly should continue to be supported and practiced, but they're not better than or more important than the ballet folklorico or the creation of a textile or the creation of a weaving or the storytelling that one does in sharing memories and experiences. Mm-hmm. I mean, to be a storyteller in some cultures is truly an art. And if you think about it, we do value storytellers because in our society, those people that are articulate and can share information in a way that's engaging often will gain support politically or gain support in business that otherwise they would not have. And we're not recognizing that those are storytelling skills, but in fact, they are. Their ability to engage people with information is what makes them successful. In when we value those things, we teach our young people to use those skills. It does two things. It makes them better presenters and better able to share their message, whatever that message may be. But it also allows them to learn and preserve their history, because it's through those stories that are shared with them, and then when they internalize it and recount those stories, then they become better individuals because they understand their history, where they came from, about their roots and their ancestry. And we all are better when we have those things. It's no surprise that museums and cultural institutions exist, because every cultural group has tried to find a way to preserve their history. What has been unfortunate is that not all groups have been invited to participate equally. But once we do that, once we learn to value which each of us bring to society, we then become a better society, because there aren't values placed on our culture. Mm-hmm. That somehow one is higher than another. But I think as we get better at sharing our own stories, like the Yonsei Project, or even the Great Box Collective, which is the other African-American project that I'm working, that we work with. They talk about the African-American heritage, and strengthening young African-American women is a big part of what they're doing, and kind of valuing what they bring to our society. And it's all of those different things that that we learn, that allow us to learn from each other and allow us to just grow as individuals.
Here's Jonelle with Bryn Saito of the Yonsei Memory Project.
Bryn Saito is a fourth generation Japanese and Korean American poet and educator. Bryn teaches in the Master of Fine Arts Creative Writing Program at California State University, Fresno. I'm going to begin, if I may, by reading a couple of lines from the Yonsei Memory Project webpage. I think these lines do a good job of encapsulating some of the challenges you're trying to accomplish here. It takes energy and commitment to make space in our daily lives to remember our ancestors and our histories. It takes spiritual courage to remember past suffering and maintain hope for healing and the future. It is heavy to think about the stories we've lost already. Why bother putting in the work? This sounds like a lot of work and a lot of suffering. What is at stake if we lose these memories?
Yeah, that's such a great question. Nikiko Masumoto and I, my co-founder and I, we really came together. 2017 was a kind of a pivotal moment in our community because it was the 75th anniversary of the Executive Order 9066 that led to the eventual incarceration of our family and our grandparents and our elders. And it was also the year that the Muslim ban was put into effect, and the border wall was going up, and it was a year of a lot of intensity when it came to civil liberties and issues of immigration and borders. And so we were just seeing these very similar patterns, you know, things that were happening in the Latinx community and the Muslim community in Fresno were the same things that were happening that happened to our family and our parents and our grandparents. So we thought this is such a powerful moment to resurface those stories of the Japanese American incarceration. I've heard it said, you know, at least a couple years ago that maybe about 70% of the country still didn't know, you know, that the Japanese community and Japanese Americans were incarcerated during World War II.
Yes, I have been throughout this podcast series, we have been interviewing some of the descendants, right, of the Japanese incarceration who never learned about it in school and had to go away to college to find out about the history in their own families because their families didn't talk about it. It was considered
exactly
some families very shameful, right? Mm-hmm. So the idea that our schools and our families weren't preparing us to have these difficult conversations, right? That's a thread that we're always going to have to deal with.
Exactly. Yeah. So I think under those, with all of that in mind, we just thought, oh, this is a powerful moment to do this kind of memory work. Even though it is emotionally difficult and heavy, it just seemed like we need to continue to tell these stories.
Right. And let's zoom in on some of that difficult and challenging memory work through a project called the Days of Remembrance. Can you tell me more about that?
Yeah, so our first Days of Remembrance, I think happened in 2018. And that was one of our first big programs that we did that was sponsored by the California Civil Liberties Public Education Program and the California State Library. And Day of Remembrance sort of signifies that day, February 19th in 1942, when the executive order went out and that led to the incarceration. So every February 19th is a big sort of memory day for the community. So we thought, well, what can we do? What kind of programming can we do for our Central Valley community? And a lot of our work has been sort of lighting up the different monuments and places of memory in the Central Valley. Again, because many of our Central Valley community many in our Japanese American Central Valley community weren't aware, you know, that the Fresno Fairgrounds was used as a detention center before folks actually went to the camps further east. They were held at the fairgrounds, you know, they were held.
That doesn't seem fair.
Yeah, I know. The fairgrounds turned into this sort of makeshift prison, and folks slept in the animal stalls and made their own beds from the hay and were there for maybe a few months before then being sent to the camps. And there's a memorial there. And so we thought, well, some of our work for Day of Remembrance can be actually going to these sites and taking a busload of people, mostly Japanese American folks, but also folks who just had an interest in the history and wanted to be, you know, really do the work of allyship and learn alongside our community. So we took a bus that day and we visited some of these detention center sites in the valley. And we went to a monument created by an Armenian American farmer, the Simonian Tower. It's the tower at Simonian Farms. And he created that monument from wood from the Poston Barracks, out of a sense of honoring the Japanese American farmers that taught his Armenian farming community how to farm in the valley. And so when the Japanese Americans were sent to the camps, he was just so incensed and so upset and created this, what he calls the soul consoling tower from the barrack wood, in honor of that, of honor of those people that taught him how to farm. So we went there with our community. And at each of these sites, we do some kind of arts-based activity, which is where the arts and storytelling kind of came in. Maybe we do a listening exercise or write some poetry or just record the senses and turn that into a poem. Or we did some like kind of eye gazing with each other. We did a little bit of silent meditation. And so we use these different modalities to sort of activate those places of history and activate those monuments in a different way than just reading the plaques or walking around. Right,
in a non-tourist or a non-visiting sort of way.
Exactly. And really communing.
I can imagine that exchanging eye contact can be a very intimate way of accessing a monument.
Yes, and that was really our goal, I think, was to create intimate spaces, intimate memory spaces, and build community with each other, among the participants on that bus, and not just sort of casually, wander through, but actually sort of be with each other and get to know each other through that experience.
I think I'd like to be on that bus, maybe. Do you think locally, or was this a one-time project?
We did it for a few years in a row, which was wonderful. And we do have plans to, every DOR, do some kind of offering, depending, you know, on our funding and depending on our time. And we'd love to continue to do that local memory bus work.
So Lilia, I'd love for you to tell us a little bit about your role at the Fresno Arts Council.
In August, it will be 10 years that I came to the Fresno Arts Council. The Fresno Arts Council, like many arts councils across the state and the country, suffered during the recession and during the lean times when there were no funds, with our minimum funds coming from the California Arts Council. So when I came, our most stable funding was $12,000. Wow. From the California Arts Council. And it has been a uphill climb ever since. But I'm very pleased to say that with a good supportive board and the bringing on of staff over time as we could afford it, we now are operating $1 million budget project.
Wow, that's incredible.
So for an arts council, we're doing quite well. And part of that has to do with the way we've developed our programs and services. As an arts council, you respond to the needs of your community. primarily your role is to be a support to the field. So how you define that is kind of very, very much dependent on the needs of your community. We also looked at how do we deliver service to the arts community that is evolving or that is just emerging. Because Fresno, of course, doesn't have a large economic base that can support the arts. So, and when I say that, I mean that we have a very high level of poverty. Mm-hmm. And so it, in order to engage a full cross-section of the community, we have to make sure that our projects and events are affordable. And we also have to look at how do we strengthen arts organizations. So whether it's the Yonsei project or it's Breakbox Collective or Dante's Drumming Circle. Those are projects that are individual artist-led, but emerging, and opportunities for them to develop their work, but they as individual artists don't have the administrative capacity and or desire to manage all of the bookkeeping and record keeping that goes along with receiving grants and accessing resources. And so we then provide a fiscal receiver project so that individual artists can come through us. And unlike just a pass-through, we actually hold people's hands as they go through this process. If it's grant writing assistance that they need, we sit down with them and walk through a grant process and help them apply for a grant. If it's financial management and understanding how to develop invoices and agreements with other artists that they contract with, well, we provide that assistance and we teach them how to do that. Those are the kinds of supports that often organizations, as they're just evolving, need. Mm-hmm. And in the arts community, we're no different. Artists have developed their craft. They're working on what they love to do. They don't want to be administrators.
Right.
They didn't go into the arts to do that. However, it's part of the work if you're going to develop programs. And so we
And if you work, want to be successful, you need
if you want to yeah. be successful, you have to pay your bills, mm-hmm. you have to receive cash, you have to manage it. I mean, those are all things that we all have to do in our daily lives, but it becomes an even greater issue when you're soliciting support from outside sources.
Your organization occupies a really unique landscape in California known as the Central Valley. What kind of a place is Fresno, California?
That's a great question. So sometimes when we say the Great Central Valley, we're thinking about that landscape that's the Sacramento Valley, the San Joaquin Valley, and then I think it's called the Tulare Basin or something. And when I was little, somebody described it to me as the armpit of California. So
that before.
Yeah, that's well, not that great.
To clarify that.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, the valley, you know, primarily known for just the agriculture and the agricultural output that feeds, you know, like a quarter of this nation's harvest, you know, comes right from the Central Valley, from the basin of California there. And so it's very sort of rich with those layers of land and history. I believe it was the Yokut and the Miwok Native Americans that were the, you know, original inhabitants of the Central Valley. And it's a very diverse place. You know, Fresno is sort of the main city right there in the middle, and we're about 500,000 people. So it's a large, you know, it's a very large, robust city, but also has a sort of small town feel. It's a very like community-based, community-oriented place, lots of cultural diversity, linguistic diversity, lots of sons and daughters of immigrants who worked the land, you know, like my family, and of course the Latinx immigrant communities that are living there now, just this legacy of really working that land in the valley. So there's a lot of just sense of place and rootedness and sometimes small town thinking, which can be frustrating, you know, at times, but also just a lot of richness as well.
How beautiful. It sounds to me like you're more so describing the heart rather than the armpit.
The yes.
Right?
Oh, I love that metaphor. That's great.
You do a lot of work in your community, right? Not just leading buses and eye contact exercises, but in addition to your roles as educator and community activist, you're also a poet. You're a word worker. And I'm very curious to learn a little bit more about the relationship between your poetry and the memory work that you do.
Mm-hmm.
Do they overlap?
Yeah, I think more and more so they do. It's doing the memory work has really shaped how I think about poetry. Poetry now, I see poetry more as this kind of community-based, multivocal thing, you know, like it's not just me alone in a room, like writing about my feelings.
Right.
There's sort of these different portals that are get opened up, I think, when you're in communion with the ancestors or with the past or with history, and you're listening in these different ways and you hear different voices. And I'm moving more towards like a documentary poetry too, that brings in the stories, you know, that I'm learning from the elders, that we're learning from each other, like snippets and quotes and lines, and from their memories will enter into my work. And of course the question is how to do that in a way that's ethical and also aesthetic and also sort of pays tribute to the multivocality that my poetry is kind of becoming. So that's kind of interesting. It's a new aesthetic for me. It's a new way of thinking about the poem. The poem isn't just, it's like my feelings aren't just my feelings. Like sometimes my feelings are intergenerational or they're
memories.
They're of the community. And so there's a sort of broadening, I think, of my aesthetic as a poet from this work. Yeah.
That's beautiful. I've read that your organization, after exploring some of these traumas, right, after doing the memory work that you do regarding the Japanese internment, regarding the current violations of our civil liberties promised to us by the Bill of Rights, after all this, I've read that you have more questions than when you started the memory project. Mm-hmm. What are some of those questions?
Definitely. Isn't that the way with learning and knowledge? It's what I hope for my students, you know.
Nesting like dolls.
Yes, just walk away with questions or walk away with the ability to question and inquire into the world, because there are no answers and the answers shift and change. I think a question alive for me right now, sort of, you know, in the wake of the recent Black Lives Matter protests and thinking about what truly is solidarity, you know, and how do we lean into that? And within the Asian American community and Japanese American community, there has been, you know, anti-Black racism. What was alive is alive. And the sort of myth of the model minority, which has kept us in these different silos, which has kept maybe some folks in our community from really thinking about how our struggles are similar and different, you know, but rooted in these similar patterns of racism and incarceration and detention. So I guess a question alive for me is how do we reach into those places of discomfort and lean into that discomfort in this moment and ask, how can we use maybe the resources we have or the privileges we have as a community to lift up the voices of others, and also do the work of kind of self-inquiry or community inquiry that maybe has kept us from moving into those spaces of discomfort or thinking about the racism that's alive in our community and thinking about the intersectionality that's alive in our community too. You know, Nikiko and I are both of mixed ancestry in a way. Nikiko is Japanese American, you know, she's also white. I'm Korean American and Japanese American. Many of our colleagues and folks we've worked with are half Black and half Japanese. And so within our very community, there's this rich intersectionality that I'd love to explore more and think more into, especially in this moment.
2020 is such a fascinating year, and it feels like it's charged with the capacity for us to evolve as a society with everything that's been happening with like the protests. How do you see your community and the art community in your sights responding and reacting and changing along with it?
Anytime there is a major unrest or major upheaval in a community, people begin to be a little introspective and begin to look at, okay, what are we doing? What happened? What caused this? And how do we fix it? You know, we're real good at trying to fix things. And so I think that with the arts and through the arts, we help people feel less threatened by information that needs to clearly come before them. And so whether it's a mural or a painting of many fists in the air, or it's a beautiful street painting of Black Lives Matter that we just presented in front of City Hall, it allows people to stop and contemplate and think, because that's what art does. It also is healing in that the people in developing these things, as they processed creating these works of art, they engaged in something that made them feel like they were doing something about the problem. You know, they were actively doing something. They were sharing a message. They were painting on the street. And, you know, I'm part of this. I'm doing my part. So then it isn't an individual, but it's a community that is engaged in this healing and this sharing. But I think more importantly, if we can stay on track, there's more conversation about the issues of equity, and particularly racial equity. And there's also more dialogue and exchange of information. And I'm seeing more people try to understand. And that is what's important, that people take the time to listen and understand. I see more and more people that are interested in participating in the aspect of understanding and also changing, because equity does not mean equal. Equity means that we have designed a way so that everyone has access. The issue of equity is one of those things that we really need to remain vigilant, and we need to continue to push that message that everyone should have access to opportunities for growth and education, and certainly in the arts. Everyone should have access to the arts, because the arts are for everyone, and everyone is creative.
For my audience out there, for my beautiful global audience out there, here is your challenge. We'd like you to do something to think about something that's uncomfortable, mm-hmm. but important, so that we can lift each other up.
No, I love that question. And to even reflect, yeah, when do you feel uncomfortable and when do you feel comfortable? You know, maybe this, yeah, it's like and why, and what's, when you're in a certain space, what makes you feel safe, unsafe, comfortable, not comfortable? How do you lean into that? And yeah, just encouraging always, like I tell my students, to lead with that inquiry, lead with that questioning. And if you have an arts practice, I think for so many of us as writers, so much of writing is about asking those questions and coming to the page just utterly confused and utterly lost and utterly like, what's going on? What is happening? And that's exactly where you should be, and write about it and use your arts practice to write into that.
Thank you to our guests, Lilia Chavez and Bryn Saito. To find out more about them and their work, visit FresnoArtsCouncil.org and YonseiMemoryProject.com. Chapters Podcast was produced by Heritage Future and made possible with support from Chapman University and California Civil Liberties Public Education Program, a state-funded grant project of the California State Libraries. For more information, visit heritagefuture.org, chapman.edu, and library.ca.gov.